Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Prudence Pfeiffer. She's an art historian, a writer, and an editor specializing in modern and contemporary art. And we're going to be talking about her new book, The Slip, The New York City Street That Changed American Art Forever. Prue, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book. This is one of the most enjoyable art and interesting art histories I've read in some time.
Mark, thank you so much for having me.
Now, this is a book not just about the artists, though, and this is one of the things that makes this book so unique. It really is about place, and you write about that, and you write that place is an undervalued determinant in creative output. Can you just extend on that?
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, this is a book about a group of artists living in this very obscure little street in downtown New York City for a very brief period of time. And it had always sort of come up to me as an art historian as a kind of footnote in art history and just little bits and bobs here and there. And so when I started to dig into what this street was and why these very different kinds of artists all came together for this brief moment to live there, I wanted to know more about the history of the street itself. And what I discovered was that, that it was, you know, even though at the time, even in the 1950s, it was sort of an unknown street, considered very obscure, and a lot of people didn't know where it was, and it was really not inhabited after 5 p.m., except for by...
Drunks.
But, yeah, by the artists and some vagrants and some sailors coming home to the Siemens Church Institute, the special hotel for them on shore leave that was at the end of Coenties Slip. But it actually turns out that this was, you know, one of the first streets in the colony, one of the central streets in the city of Manhattan in the 18th and 19th centuries, where, you know, huge ships would come in and had one of the busiest central markets, and had this whole other history, maritime history and, you know, industrial history and of a lot of different kinds of labor and communities that lived there before the artists. And that whole history, I found, really did make its way into not just what the artists were thinking about, but what they were actually physically making. Because the other part of the story is that, you know, when the artists moved there in the 50s and 60s, this was already a period of incredible construction and demolition.
Yeah.
In that, I mean, all over the city, but particularly in that area, one of the oldest areas of New York City, because it had so many kind of low 18th and 19th century buildings, you know, maritime warehouses, and this was a moment when, you know, real estate's at a premium, and so those are all kind of being knocked down to build really tall skyscrapers. It's this kind of pivotal moment when we see a shift in industry to the financial industry downtown, as opposed to, you know, maritime industry there. And so they are, these artists are literally salvaging the material from these older buildings to bring into their artwork, and, you know, in part because they couldn't afford other supplies, and in part because they were really attuned to and interested in that American history and what, you know, how they could be a piece of it or make their own, sort of remake their own history through those materials.
Okay. How do you pronounce the name of the street?
So it's a great question. I pronounce it Coenties Slip, which is how...
Okay, that's not what Willem de Koenig said.
Exactly, yeah. So that is kind of what has stuck. And I think sort of is the best way to show this contraction. So what we... You know, what we know from history is that we think that Coenties Slip was named after a an early Dutch settler, Conrad ten Eyck, and his wife, Anetja, and it was an area where they were living. And so it was a contraction of their two names, which I also love because it's sort of rare that a woman gets a place named after her. And I guess sort of ever, but, you know, particularly in that early moment, of the colony. And so the sort of coentes, the coe, that sort of allows for that contraction. But it is true, an anecdote that I tell in the book, one of the artists, Jack Youngerman, was talking with Willem de Kooning, the amazing abstract expressionist artist who, you know, famously was Dutch, and he told Youngerman that it should be pronounced Kuntes. But Coentes has stuck. Yeah.
Now, the group of artists we're talking about, I'm just going to list them quickly before we get into specifics. Robert Indiana, Ellsworth Kelly, Agnes Martin, James Rosenquist, Delphine, is it Sarig?
Sarig, yeah.
Leonor Tawney and Jack Youngerman. These artists all find themselves in this very unusual spot, in these very unusual buildings, the end of the 50s into the 60s. Now, their art doesn't necessarily relate to each other, and they didn't even really, they hung out, but they also found a lot of time for themselves. The term you use is collective solitude in this area. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So, I was really, one of the things that drew me to this group of artists, besides the fact that there wasn't a lot about them during this period and about their time in this place, and I really wanted to know more, was I remember I was reading this great biography of Agnes Martin, and I was reading a little bit more about this time, and I said, wait, what? Like, James Rosenquist was there too?
Yeah.
It's just such a strange, unexpected mix of artists, and some are, more well-known than others. I didn't know much at all about Leonor Tawney, and I came away from my project, from this book project, just having so much admiration and respect for her and really feeling like she's one of the central forces, frankly, in post-war American art in terms of, the importance of fiber art and how she also collected and supported other artists. So, but I thought, what was fascinating to me is that, as you point out, there was this way in which they did support each other and, visit each other's studio and help bring gallerists by to each other and support each other in some very practical ways, which usually, doesn't find its way into art history, but I find really fascinating, like paying someone's electric bill helping someone when they're having a mental breakdown. But they also, really it felt like they all respected this need, and part of the reason why they were living in this place, to have apartness, to have time alone to work. And even though they ranged in age, I think from 24 to 50 when they were arriving on the slip, they all were really starting out. And it was at the slip that they had sort of their breakthroughs into what they wanted to do with their life and with their art.
That was the amazing thing that came through your book, is that for many of them, they really found their style while they were here.
Yes.
Now, I just want to describe, if people are listening, don't understand this. This slip goes right down to the water. So there's a lot in your book of people looking outside their windows and seeing boats go by.
Yes.
And it's literally a place that's like sort of at the end of or the edge of something. So there's that feeling to the place too.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I mean, so Youngerman and some of the other artists talked about leaving the city to go home to Coenties Slip, which of course was not true. It is a part of the city, but it is that sense of it being so quiet at night too, when, with stock market closed and, the Fulton Fish Market doesn't open until, really early in the morning. So it is a moment, and it was an area at the time that was incredibly desolate really at night, and they were living illegally in commercial maritime warehouses and old sail making lofts. So the landlords were kind of turning the other way, and they were living and working there. So yes, there's
what
a way
amazing,
in which
it's just an amazing story.
Yeah.
And the thing is, each of them came from someplace else. Now, what was going on in the city? Art is abstract expressionism and Pollock and that ilk. That was the big thing.
Yes.
And so they really wanted to find a place where they could step outside of that and then find their own vision.
Yes, and it's interesting. I mean, you know, so yes, as you point out, they all came from outside of New York City, and they did have that itch of, you know, coming to the city to, you know, be at the center of where everything was happening, and, you know, to be a part of that world and to meet other artists. But Youngerman and Kelly, Ellsworth Kelly, had met in Paris when they were both there on the GI Bill, going to school there. And they were hesitant about what was going on back home because even as they admired the abstract expressionist artists and saw all the incredible press they were getting and this kind of shift even from kind of Europe to New York as being, you know, this kind of center of the avant-garde of art making, they also knew that wasn't quite the art for them. And so they wondered if there was kind of a place for them in the city. And so, yes, I think that, you know, Kwani Slip allowed them also to have a bit of a separateness to really, you know, experiment and see what was happening. And, you know, interestingly, just around the corner were two other important artists trying to, you know, work their way out from the shadow of abstract expressionism and figure out a new way forward, Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg.
Yeah,
But even they were, you know, already kind of, as Indiana said, too successful to be a part of our group. And I think, you know, there was just, you know, even though they did visit each other's studio, and it was a pretty separate moment for them in terms of the artists on the slip.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Prudence Pyfer. She's an art historian, a writer, and an editor specializing in modern and contemporary art. And her new book, The Slip, New York City Street That Changed American Art Forever. You mentioned Youngerman and Kelly in Paris. By the way, that section of the book was great.
Oh, thank you.
It was so vivid. It was cinematic in its appreciation of these people living in dire poverty and trying to do their work, and then going out and seeing people like Jean Arp, Brancusi. They showed up at Matisse's place, and I mean, all the stuff was going on, and it almost seemed like, why would they ever come back?
Yeah, I mean,
but
I think
they felt,
you know,
like they had to, that America was where it was happening at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for all of the incredible, you know, and particularly for Jack Youngerman, who was, you know, as he said, this kind of, you know, boy from Kentucky who hadn't seen a lot of art at all before he went to France. So everything was this huge revelation. And it was a moment when, you know, they were, like, he talked about going to see the Lascaux Caves, some of the earliest art ever made, and his guide was the boy who discovered it. You know, this was a moment when things were just still very open, and, of course, so many of the museums were free for them to go to with their student pass, and obviously, you know, the churches, and so it was just this moment of really soaking up art history, and then also there were so many artists who they got to just, you know, meet Giacometti and Brancusi.
Jesus.
Kind of just like, you know, open moment. And so I think it was a wonderful education, but it also, you know, the contemporary scene there was pretty closed off to Americans still, and wasn't, you know, where they felt like they could really move forward and move ahead. And so Kelly returns back to the States first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a sort of famous anecdote that he sees an image of an Ad Reinhardt exhibition or reviewed in Art News. And Reinhardt's famous for his black monochrome paintings. But, you know, sort of a very austere kind of abstraction that was quite different from his abstract expressionist contemporaries. And that gave Kelly the courage to think, okay, there are people doing things in New York that, you know, that I kind of, you know, am really intrigued by, and that I think, you know, my kind of abstraction, you know, could find a place there as well. And I love that anecdote because actually, you know, a long time ago, I wrote my dissertation on Ad Reinhardt. So it's just funny how you find, like, you don't think there's really a connection between the projects that you do, but of course there always are these little threads of intrigue. But yes, and I mean, the Paris, I also love the time in Paris because it was also a way to kind of set up you know, in some sense, this new moment in modern art that really is about an American ethos, particularly when you get to the moment of James Rosenquist and Robert Indiana. Sure. And, you know, and really how they were thinking about bringing in pop culture. And, you know, they call themselves, they sort of rejected the term pop, but, you know, called themselves American painters, and how they really were bringing in what they saw on the street and, you know, in packaging and on signs and that, you know, that sense of really bringing in the landscape in that way.
I just want to talk about a couple of people in brief.
Yeah.
And I do want to mention, your descriptions of people in place are so vivid and detailed that they're wonderful in this book.
Oh, thank you.
Betty Parsons, the gallery owner. I love your description of her.
Yes.
Book. Just talk about it. I mean, she was critical to these artists because she would show their work for the first time here in America.
Yeah, and she's just really an amazing figure. She was an artist in her own right, and a, you know, by all accounts, sort of a terrible business person.
That's right. It's so, like, and then she would she would help an artist up to a point, and then sort of forget about them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that she just, you know, there were some maybe decisions she made that were she liked to be able to go out to her house on the North Fork and do art on the weekends, and that was a good time actually when, you know, dealers and people would want to be coming by the gallery to see art. So that was sort of a problem for some of the artists, but, you know, really amazing figure. She came from a wealthy family who actually lost a lot of their money. She was married and divorced very early in her life, lived with women for the rest of her life, and had just this kind of fierce vision about, you know, the artists that she loved and wanted to support, and had a really wonderful eye and found, you know, really a lot of artists. And, you know, famously, she was representing many of the abstract expressionist artists who ended up leaving her, in part for some of the reasons that, you know, I'm saying, and in part because this is also a moment when you have this kind of rise in the gallery dealer and the art market, and it just becomes a much more kind of competitive scene. But that actually gave some room then to, you know, for the artists of Coney Slip. So she, when Kelly came, you know, back to New York, but back to the States, he ended up showing with Betty Parsons.
That's right.
And she had also been traveling in New Mexico and seen the work of Agnes Martin, another of the artists who end up coming into the Slip. And she actually encourages Martin to move back to New York City. She had been there earlier for teaching college. And so Martin does and ends up also settling on the Slip, in part because of, you know, Parsons introducing her to Kelly and that group of artists. And then, you know, Kelly also encourages Parsons to visit younger men. And so in a way also there was the kind of promise of a show if younger men comes back to New York as well from Paris. So,
Let's talk about Agnes Martin. She's a really complicated figure. Incredibly complicated. She, as you write, lived at a slight remove from reality.
Yeah.
She was known for her blueberry muffins. I learned that from your book. I can't believe that. She became the mercurial den mother of the Slip, in your words. She was an interesting person. She, as you mentioned, she had been in New Mexico, and she was sort of painting these biomorphic abstractions, and she really just got tired of it while she was at the Slip. And she wanted to do something different.
Yeah. I mean, she talks about that when she came, you know, when she moved back to New York and moved into her loft at the Slip, she just started kind of painting, you know, just maniacally and, you know, painting and throwing paintings out and painting. And she, all her life, she was very, she really edited her work incredibly.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, certain artists who don't do that at all, and others who are very careful about their work. And she, again, you know, this is one of the reasons that I came to really admire Lenore Tawney so much, too, as an artist and a figure. You know, she and Tawney became really good friends, possibly lovers, we don't know for sure, but certainly they had an incredible close relationship. And Tawney bought many of Agnes Martin's early experiments at the Slip, which included actually sculptural assemblages, which, you know, thanks to a few really incredible, you know, major retrospectives of Martin's work recently, we know about more, but they hadn't really been very well known for a long time, and we just think of Martin as a painter. But in fact, she made these really beautiful assemblages, but she destroyed most of them. But because Tawny bought them, and she bought them because she admired them, but also to support her friend, because Martin really had no money, and Tawny was one of the only people, only artists at the Slip who wasn't really struggling to, you know, to make ends meet and even afford supplies, let alone, you know, be able to be buying artwork. But yes, I mean, but it was an incredible, important time for Martin because she did, it's where she kind of says, she'd been painting for 20 years, but it's where she kind of really came into the kind of work that then, you know, she would become most famous for in terms of her really beautiful abstractions that have kind of grids. And I mean, she started making her kind of orb abstractions as well. So getting down to a little bit more of a kind of purity, what she calls perfection. but also, you know, incorporating a lot of the colors and the lines that she was observing in her new environment as well. And
we're going to run out of time because we could talk about this for years. But I want to mention Lenore Tawny because of all the artists, I knew nothing about her until I read your book.
Yeah.
And I ended up sort of Googling her artwork. Although I want to mention you have lots of color, slides in the book. But I had to look at more of her work, and her work was fascinating. She was a fabric artist.
Yeah.
She was a weaver. People described her as a sprite. She was very sophisticated and had ecstatic experiences.
Yeah, I mean, she talks about, and I love that you Googled more images. That makes me so happy. I did try to, put as many images as possible in the book. So yeah, there's a nice
there's
color,
tons.
And there's lots of black and white throughout the book too. And which I'm so happy that I could have.
How come we don't know more about her?
Well, I mean, this is, always the great question about, how history is written and who writes it and where we see it. But I
plus
do think
the fact
that
she was doing fabric at that time.
Well, exactly. And I think, that is a part of the story, is that even as, this starts to be a kind of really breakthrough moment, and she was having, she had a solo exhibition at the Staten Island Museum and at the Museum of Arts and Design, but it was still at that moment kind of relegated to craft versus fine art. And, it's just in the moment when MoMA is actually starting to collect fiber art and to really try to be thinking about it in within the broader sphere of modern art and not as this kind of separate thing. And, and part of that also is a racist history, because a lot of, the people who were working in fiber arts were, Native Americans,
right.
African Americans, and women. So it's just, it's a sad occlusion, but I do think that, we are now starting, thankfully, to see much more of those artists kind of being brought into the light and for people to hear more about them. Tawny, she had some of my favorite kind of moments from the story that I learned was just, thinking about these huge, she made these incredibly ambitious woven forms that were, 14 feet tall, and she had to climb up on the rafters of her sailing loft to like tie them up onto the sail hoist to lift them up in order to be able to see them. And she's tying the ends with sailor knots and literally like in her rocking chair doing that as she's looking outside at the tugboats that have the same knots on the side of that, their bows. So she was incredibly, related to the landscape of where she was and, thinking about that history as well.
We're almost completely out of time, but there's so much we could talk about, like Rosenquist, who arrives from Minnesota, and his sign painting, which was very a dangerous occupation because he had to be up at a height, and literally developing the art style that he would become famous for. That's just one story.
Yeah.
There's the story of Jack Youngerman and Delphine Seyrig, which for my money is, and I mentioned to you this before, it's definitely cinematic. I mean, somebody's got to make a movie out of that. I mean, she was an actress. She was always looking for a job, and she ended up meeting, she was French and met Youngerman in Paris, and she met a French director who sort of swept her away.
Yeah.
And she left Youngerman, she left her son.
So yeah, I mean, it's really, it's an amazing story. And it's also, you know, she was so young and
yeah.
she, I think the other kind of amazing thing is in her time when she came to New York to the Slip, she ended up starring in this, you know, cult beat film, Pull My Daisy, of Jack Kerouac, you know, and Ginsberg, and everyone's in it. And there's Delphine Seyrig as sort of one of the main characters, which was, you know, very unexpected because she was not actually really a part of that scene, although she knew Robert Frank, and that was sort of her entree into that film. But as you mentioned, you know, she ends up leaving the Slip to go back to Paris and star in Last Year at Marienbad.
And, oh, my
God. And become, you know, one of the most iconic French actors of all time, and also an incredible activist as well.
Yep. I mean, they all were there. Now, what happened eventually is that a lot of these buildings just got torn down.
Yes. So, spoiler alert, which is not a spoiler alert at all, because I think I say it in like the first few lines of the book. But yeah, I mean, you know, even as the artists moved there in the 50s, they knew that it was a time. It was sort of a contingent place because, you know, much like all of New York, but you know, particularly accelerated in that time and in that place. These buildings were all, you know, so many of these buildings were being razed, being torn, as in, you know, demolished to make way for new construction, a lot of, you know, in the banking industry and a lot of sort of glass skyscrapers. And again, yeah, we don't have time to get into it, but one of the kind of crazy things that I did not expect that Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs and, you know, would be a part of my story around of the Slip, but they, you know, Robert Moses ends up being a very important figure in the book for the artists, both as, you know, someone who helps to bring them more renown with the World's Fair in 1964 and a lot of
Amazing.
The Slip artists, and then also, you know, threatening the very place where they live. So, yeah.
And this may sound silly, is there a plaque or anything to commemorate the fact that these amazing artists all lived there?
You know, it's not a silly question at all. And someone else recently asked me that, and there is not. And
it sounds
really
like
does.
A perfect idea.
I know. I mean, there's one building still extant that they lived in, 35 Coenties Slip. It's the only one still standing. You can go and see it. And the Slip's a little bit different these days. There's a CBD dispensary there,
oh my God.
among other things. But I mean, it would be great. And it's funny, you know, my father loves those historic markers. And so we always would like stop the car whenever we saw one. And, you know, they are all over New York City. And, you know, there's the house where Wallace Stevens wrote a lot of his poems is, you know, has a marker in the village. So
we're going to have to go. But that's something I hope this book sort of pushes that idea forward.
It would be great. Yeah.
My guest tonight is Prudence Pfeiffer. She's an art historian, a writer, and an editor specializing in modern and contemporary art, and she's written an amazing art history book, The Slip, The New York City Street That Changed American Art Forever. Prudence, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.